This is The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. What if healing mental health isn't about managing symptoms, but getting to the root of what's really going on? Today, we're joined by Keith Kurlander and Dr. Will Vanderveer, co-authors of Psychedelic Therapy, a Revolutionary Approach to Restoring Your Mental Health and Reclaiming Your Life.
As co-founders of the Integrative Psychiatry Institute and Centers, they bring decades of clinical experience to a growing conversation around trauma, healing, and the role of psychedelic-assisted therapy. They'll help us explore how this emerging approach works, what a safe and ethical healing process looks like, and why, while not for everyone, it's offering new hope for people seeking deeper, more lasting change. Keith Kurlander, Will Vanderveer, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start with you, Will. This type of therapy has been talked about. It has become popularized, but it seems like we always come back to sort of the same thing. Maybe it's been a bit of an uphill battle because psychedelics were recreational. Can you talk about that battle and what it means and why maybe people should disregard thinking about its recreational use instead of its therapeutic use?
Right. The reality is that in the 1950s and 60s, before Timothy Leary recommended everyone should take psychedelics, it was actually research first. So it was being developed as a treatment tool before it escaped the clinic. And when the cultural impact of that started to get out of control, Richard Nixon passed the Controlled Substance Act, which shut everything down. We do have a huge stigma. We have a huge cultural public education task in front of us to help people understand what the opportunity is and what the risks are of using this in a clinical context versus a recreational one.
Your book highlights the massive impact that trauma can have on mental health and how it doesn't always derive from the kind of single damaging event or situation that many of us imagine. Can you share your working definition of what trauma is and describe how it drives so many mental health challenges?
I could take that. So we like to think of trauma not as an event per se, but a process inside the body. And that process is emerging from the nervous system. So we all have a threat response system. The whole animal kingdom does. And that threat response system is very ancient. It's, you know, used for an evolutionary purpose to survive. And in humans, there's a lot of complexity to what threat is, obviously, because we're very social animals. So there's a ton of complexity of what threat might be. And so our threat response system, when it's working well, gets triggered, and we know these terms fight or flight. There's also the freeze response, the full collapse response. We know these, most people know these terms. And it gets triggered in the event that there's a threat. And then if you return to homeostasis after the threat response system shuts back off and your nervous system is operating in homeostasis. And we're moving about our day. But often with humans, we're exposed to repeated perceived threats or actual threats, and the nervous system doesn't quite reset to homeostasis, and the fight, flight, freeze, collapse response starts getting triggered repeatedly when there's no threats present. So trauma is the process where the threat response system is triggering when there's no threat present. And that can be happening anywhere from a couple times a day to all day long if you're very traumatized. But when we say it's trauma is when then it manifests in symptoms, right? So the threat response system is overactive or underactive in some cases. And then you start getting symptoms, and those symptoms can be wide ranging. There's so much research on the association of trauma and adverse childhood experiences to all types of chronic disease, as well as mental health conditions. So when we look at mental health conditions specifically, we like to say that, and there's plenty of research to back this up, but one primary root cause of most mental health conditions as one of the causes is trauma. You have a dysregulated nervous system. Again, it's not an event. It's that you have a system in dysregulation in your nervous system, and that could lead to mental health symptoms. There's other causes too, but that's one that's probably very ubiquitous to anyone that's suffering to a high degree.
That's so interesting because I think so many people, when they think of mental health conditions, think of it in kind of some of the modern wisdom about chemical imbalances. They think of it as the nuts and bolts that are going on in the brain, not that it could be a systemic nervous system issue. So this is really interesting. How does psychedelic therapy specifically help people access and process trauma in ways that conventional therapies don't?
Well, we could have a conversation about different psychedelic compounds that have different neurobiological effects on the brain and the nervous system. One theme in the research that we're seeing is that there's an opportunity for people to, what's often said by participants in studies is see the forest for the trees. So to move out of your dysregulated perspective that Keith was referring to and sort of float above that point of view and see what happened and how your nervous system is operating without being inside of that system. To me, it's sort of like a fish that's jumping out of the water and can sort of see something that usually it's the water you swim in. This is incredibly helpful because it gives you an opportunity, a glimpse of what could be your experience of being human without being so triggered by these events all the time.
Trauma certainly is really ubiquitous. I mean, we've all experienced some kind of childhood trauma, you know, whether it was being bullied on the schoolyard or having some type of other deeper trauma. It's interesting how it manifests for different people. Keith, I'm wondering for you, I know you had a very personal experience feeling like you weren't helped by conventional therapies. And when we say conventional therapies, I guess I'm thinking mostly of antidepressants, SSRIs, or something along those lines. And you found psychedelic therapy. Can you describe your experience?
Well, I have an interesting experience. I'm going to try and truncate it so that we can move through it quickly. But I went through a lot of mental health illness throughout my 20s and 30s and didn't know what was going on. Nobody was talking about trauma to me. And I went through many different types of treatment. I've taken medications in my life. I've done hundreds of hours of psychotherapy. I'm a psychotherapist, so I've studied psychotherapy, both to help others and to try and help myself. Some of that did help me, for sure. It was sort of like, you know, notches. But the thing that I finally came to, returning back to psychedelics in my mid-30s, first in an ayahuasca church in Colombia. And what I found is that it was really showing me the profound level of trauma in my nervous system, inside my body, and in my memory bank. And it took a while to understand that process. It wasn't well articulated theoretically in the late 90s, early 2000s. But then I discovered that. And that's, you know, what really brought me back to understanding how powerful psychedelic therapy could be if it's held well. So I think there's a time and place for all of it, medication even, and all these things. But we can really pigeonhole ourselves when we think medication's the only solution.
Yeah, interesting. Will, as a medical doctor, you've done a lot of research on psychedelic therapies. And when Keith mentioned ayahuasca, and I'm sure I can't even list them all, but I think immediately of psilocybin, ketamine, ayahuasca. All of your research, you know, can you sort of compare, contrast all these different types of therapies?
Well, there are two that arguably don't meet the sort of technical definition of psychedelics, but they are usually grouped in with psychedelics, which are ketamine and MDMA. Our book covers the research and the practice with psilocybin, MDMA, and ketamine, basically because these are the most either already available or about to be available compounds. So in a nutshell, ketamine is a Schedule 3 prescribable medication. It's fully legal to prescribe in a medical context. It's been around since 1970 as an anesthetic. It was discovered to have benefits for depression in the late 90s. There wasn't any major research on it until about 2006, where a big study came out showing that treatment-resistant depression was dramatically reduced after just one IV ketamine session. That led to a spinoff drug called Spravato, which is FDA approved for treatment-resistant depression. So ketamine is an interesting tool that is widely available. And it also carries a risk of addiction and people misuse it. So that's ketamine. I'll go to psilocybin next because Oregon passed a psilocybin measure. It's been widely used in Oregon now for a few years. We ran a center there and provided many sessions there. Colorado followed suit, and we're now rolling out psilocybin centers in Colorado, which is exciting. And New Mexico has recently passed a bill. And I've seen in Utah murmurs and, flurries of information about what might happen in Utah. But psilocybin is also very interesting from a mental health perspective because the research is showing that one or two sessions can provide dramatic reductions in symptoms for 6 to 12 months. So as a psychiatrist whose goal is to ideally intervene in a short-term way and help people move on and get out the door and get on with their life, having an intervention that works really well when you use it once or twice, as opposed to having to take it every day, it is a huge improvement. The third tool, MDMA, is what a tremendous amount of research has been done on PTSD. So it has a unique chemistry that increases serotonin. It increases a hormone called oxytocin, which dramatically improves interpersonal trust, which can be a huge barrier to getting good results from trauma therapy. And most of what I've been involved in is research around MDMA. And, to just put it in a very brief nutshell, the phase 2 and phase 3 data on MDMA shows across the board that people with severe long-term symptoms of PTSD, generally about 2/3 of them after 3 MDMA sessions, no longer meet criteria for PTSD. And these results are durable at least up through 12 months and beyond. Some of the data hasn't been fully collected for beyond 12 months, but to see that level of response to a treatment is really remarkable.
Well, we have our share of aging hippies here in Park City and people who've, tried things or partaken, dropping acid in the desert or doing mushrooms at music festivals, things like that. But that's a really different kind of use. Those people that I know who've taken MDMA in a recreational use have talked about how there's a huge come down afterwards, and it can be the next day after can be really depressing for some people. What's different about the dosage or the setting or the intentions when you're in a clinical setting? Maybe, Will, you could take this versus somebody who's just kind of having some fun with it.
Sure. Well, the lore around the deep come down after MDMA, much of it came out of the rave movement in the 80s and 90s. In those environments, first of all, you're taking a drug that you bought or someone gave you that hopefully has what you think has in it. But when people send these tablets in for analysis, oftentimes there's no MDMA at all in the tablet, or there might be 10% MDMA and a whole bunch of other potentially really dangerous or toxic things in there. So the other thing that happens in the rave setting is people keep redosing themselves over hours or even days. And then there's also issues with drinking alcohol with the MDMA or dehydration or hyperthermia in these hot, crowded warehouse environments. So you contrast that with 100% pure, modest dose of MDMA in a clinical setting with a therapist there who's making sure that you drink your electrolytes and your water. And what we saw in our clinical research is that you don't see this deep, often sometimes suicidal depression that people talk about, suicide Tuesdays in the rave scene. So I think it's a matter of purity of medicine. It's a matter of set and setting. It's a matter of hydration. It's sort of like part of me wants to see these compounds used in a clinical setting renamed a different name because the experience is actually so different. It's so different.
Yeah, I can imagine. Keith, let me ask you this. You guys talk about a number of different psychedelic treatments in your book and kind of the ins and outs of the different types. Again, speaking to our local community, I'm in kind of a women's meditation group and we're all a little witchy alternative and it's great, a great time. But there's a lot of talk of plant medicine. Do you differentiate between the indigenous long-standing plant medicines such as ayahuasca, ibogaine, those kind of treatments versus the ketamine, the lab-grown, the man-made components? Are you finding that there's more efficacy in one man-made versus natural, or is it just very individualized?
Well, the research is on synthetic compounds primarily. But the main difference isn't so much, I would say, about organic versus synthetic. The main difference is how things are held and done. The research is being held in therapeutic contexts, meaning that there's typically protocols of stages of the treatment. Preparation comes before the actual experience with the medicine, where you're actually going through some kind of therapeutic process to prepare. You're identifying why you're doing this. You're being screened in a certain way to make sure it's a good fit for you. And then, you know, in the dosing session, depending on what's being researched, you'll have somebody in there with you. If there's big experiences coming up, you can process those in real time. And then the follow-up is really important, which is the integration stage, where there's sometimes months of integration sessions where you're actually trying to take the experience and not have it become a memory. That was like a cool experience, and you're trying to take it and move it into your life and really transform your life, your behaviors. You know, your brain is more adaptive following these sessions, so you have an opportunity to actually do behavior change that you didn't have before. Now, the sort of alternative is many different types of things. It could be recreational use, or it could be ceremonial use, which is what you were more speaking to. And ceremonial use, depending on where you're going, has different structure than what's being researched primarily. Those structures could have rituals involved. They don't usually have a therapist sitting with you. They could have a shaman or some sort of guide. The context is extremely different. Often in those settings, it's like the medicine is your teacher. We don't talk a lot about it. You're sort of alone to work with yourself in a sense about what comes up. And so those have a time and place for plenty of people, but it's really different. You know, the context of mental health struggle in that setting is very different. And the guides around that have a very different knowledge base. So they're really two different things. And I would say that's a big difference. I mean, some people want, you know, like to talk about, you know, organic versus synthetic, and you know, all these substances, organic or synthetic, can create a psychedelic experience either way. And I'm not minimizing, you know, that the organic definitely has been around a lot longer. So there's something to be said about that.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Keith Kurlander and Dr. Will Vandeveer. They're co-authors of a new book called Psychedelic Therapy, A Revolutionary Approach to Restoring Your Mental Health and Reclaiming Your Life. They're co-founders of the Integrative Psychiatry Institute and Centers, and you can find them at psychiatryinstitute.com. So as you were speaking, Keith, I was picturing some of our listeners tuning into this. And when you got to the point where you were talking about this is not necessarily for everyone, would there be a way that you could explain in this interview who it's not for, if a person could self-select out of doing this or into?
I would say that one thing that is typically just big rule out is people who suffer from significant psychotic disorders. Taking psychedelics is usually it's just putting fuel on the fire usually. It just usually leads to more psychotic symptoms. So that's not a good fit. Then after that, there's lots of medical rule outs depending on which medicine we're looking at and things, but that wouldn't be a self-selection process. That's something that would have to be ruled out with a physician, some medical provider. Then if we go a little more deeper, I would say that there's certain people that if they're very, very overwhelmed naturally, they're very in a high, high severe level of anxiety and very agitated, they might want to go slower or know which medicine is right. You know, sometimes it's said MDMA is a softer first experience with psychedelics. It's definitely the gentlest out of all of the psychedelics we've talked about. And that's probably why it works so well with PTSD specifically. So I think generally speaking, that's what I would say. There's nuances there, and it's always good to work with someone who is trained to kind of help rule out things.
So, Dr. Will, you were talking a moment or two ago about an offshoot of ketamine, I think it was, that has been FDA approved. And it made me think about someone who's been interested in this, but they are scared. You talked about, you know, sometimes there's an MDMA that is pure MDMA, and then the kind that you might get at a rave. How do people know? I think some people would love to do this. They're just scared of what kind of product they know, you know, that they would be getting. How can they be guaranteed?
Well, when you participate in a clinical trial, obviously you're going to get something that's completely pure. When you are in a doctor's office and you're working with a drug I mentioned that's a spinoff of ketamine, it's called Spravato, then it's made by Johnson & Johnson. So it comes in a package from the pharmaceutical company. So those are carefully regulated like any medication. So you're not going to be risking anything. It sounds like you're asking me a question about recreational use maybe, or...
Yeah, I think I'm asking more about if you really want to do this in a serious therapeutic way, can you be certain? Because in some states, like I've had friends do this here in Utah, and it's not sanctioned or it's not legal at this point. So do we know that those therapists are getting pure products?
Good question. So first of all, if you're working with ketamine and you're getting it through a prescription, then I would say that's a pretty safe bet in terms of the purity of the ketamine. You know, if you're working in the therapeutic underground is what we call it, and a lot of really effective work happens in the underground. So, you know, just because Keith and I work in a regulated way and, you know, above board doesn't mean that we don't acknowledge that healing can occur in the underground for sure. But to answer your question about how do you make sure the stuff you get is pure, there's a nonprofit called Dance Safe. And Dance Safe came up out of the kind of rave community when people were having the experience I described earlier of taking things that had really negative effects that were described as MDMA but turned out not to be. So you can submit tablets to this nonprofit and have them tested. Now, many people who obtain psychedelics socially or recreationally are not excited to wait for the results to come back. So you have to exercise patience to get that result back before you take the drug, but that's one option. There's also a website called Arrowid.com. I don't know if they still do drug testing, but they post the results of what people have submitted in the past. So these are useful. And I've heard that there are test kits that can be ordered. I don't know much about that, but yeah, it's there are resources available to get things tested.
But you two run clinics. I mean, you're setting things up for a regulated clinical experience, which is what I imagine you'd recommend for people.
Absolutely.
To see marked improvement.
Yes. as a licensed DEA registrant, I'm not interested in
buying it on the corner down by the strip mall.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, let me ask you this. I think that so many people describe spiritual experiences when they have a psychedelic session. Keith, maybe you could talk to this. Do you have to have a spiritual or religious base in order for these to be effective for you?
Well, if you don't, you're going to have one soon. So, no, you don't. You know, many atheists and agnostics have done these therapies. But, you know, there's research out of John Hopkins that shows that these mystical experiences are some of the biggest experiences of people's lives, life-changing experiences. Often, I think the spiritual experiences arise in the context of your coming into it with whatever religious worldview you already have. Sometimes people come in and their worldview gets shattered of how they had constructed their idea of a spirituality or God. Then they are shown and are looking at the ways that they put false beliefs and you know, containers around what really how powerful that could be, how immense that can be. You know, the mind can only grasp what it can with language until it has a direct experience. So yeah, a lot of people come out and go, wow, I didn't realize that there's something else here, and totally life-changing for them. And then, you know, it's also seems to be very effective in end of life research.
Keith Kurlander, Will Vandeveer, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.